The reports on some kind of surveillance by an American government agency seem to arrive daily now. The latest dust-up involves the apparent tapping of the personal cell phones of foreign leaders, most notably German Chancellor Angela Merkel. She is not pleased, and neither any of the other leaders. Even before this latest round of news, Heidi Boghossian's book was in the bookstores. It's called Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. Heidi Boghossian wears many hats. She is a lawyer, but also a fairly prolific writer, co-host of a weekly legal affairs radio show based in New York, and the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. And she's our guest in the Jefferson Exchange today. Heidi, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Tell us about the National Lawyers Guild. It's an interesting concept, it sounds like.
We were formed in 1937 as an alternative to the American Bar Association, which at the time did not admit persons of color. And over the last 7 or 8 decades, we've really done what we call people's lawyering, which is to represent political and social movements that are traditionally unrepresented, and to really say that the law should be used as an instrument to protect human rights rather than property interests. And in modern days, we do a lot of what we call legal observing at large mass assemblies and protecting the rights of individuals who've been targeted by the government for their political views, and that includes what we call information activists and many others who speak out.
So when you're observing at large assemblies, you're observing the observers, in a sense?
We're observing police activity, so that if, for example, we see police engage in what we call a false mass arrest, as happened during the Occupy movement in New York on the Brooklyn Bridge, where they arrested 700, we monitor that, we take notes, and if needed, we help testify in court and provide criminal defense to the individuals who are arrested, as well as civil lawsuits after.
Over the course of a year, how many cases are you going to get like that?
Oh, well, depending on the year, I mean, during the height of the Occupy movement, we had thousands of cases across the country. Then when we have the Republican and national political conventions, we also see hundreds of mass arrests usually. And general overreaching by law enforcement, really, to keep people's messages out of reach of the delegates. But, you know, on a good year, we might just have a few hundred cases.
Heidi, you say your book has not a ghost writer, but a ghost thinker. Who was that?
Well, that is interesting because that person has been in the news himself recently. It's someone I know from the East Village where I live, and his name is Bill DePaola. He runs a volunteer organization called Time's Up, and they're an environmental group, but they also promote bicycling in the urban environment as an alternative to motorized transportation. And during the 2004 RNC in New York, the Republican convention, their group was infiltrated by police, spied on. Even the New York Times wrote several editorials and articles about the extent to which this small grassroots organization really came to the attention of law enforcement, who spent a fortune on them, monitoring them, trying to disrupt their rides. And then we found out recently that, in fact, several people, including my friend Bill, had been spied on later. The cases were opened linking them just through very tenuous evidence to a bicyclist who was reporting on the bombing a few years ago in Times Square of a recruitment center. So we find that grassroots groups are often the subject of surveillance because they're activists and they challenge corporate messages in many cases.
Well, they challenge authority generally. I mean, corporate and governmental at the same time, would you say?
Exactly.
So what are the understood limits, if there really are any understood limits? There must be certainly case law that would provide precedent here for what police are allowed to do just in sort of checking things out, keeping an eye on gatherings of people as opposed to infiltrating them or spying on them.
Well, I think it's useful to go back a few decades to answer that question, because in 1971, after the FBI officially terminated its counterintelligence programs, COINTELPRO, what happened was we had a group called the Church Committee that looked into government intelligence activities and instituted significant reforms, really, to curb unlawful spying on Americans. We had limits placed on that spying in 1976 called the Levy Guidelines after the Attorney General. But what we've seen is those protections crumbling. Within a decade of when they were enacted, then in 1981, Reagan reauthorized many domestic intelligence gathering techniques that were prohibited. Then we come to 9/11, of course, and many of those protections have been taken away. So the police are given almost carte blanche to open up, and FBI agents to open up cases. Right now, I think basically they just have to say they have a good faith belief that it should be opened, and rather than the old-fashioned standard of having reasonable suspicion or probable cause that a criminal activity was afoot.
You know, there might be some dismissals of your book on the basis of there go the liberals again complaining about surveillance that keeps us safe, but it really is much more than liberals, isn't it?
It cuts across all, you know, party lines and ideological lines in the chapter that I have on spying on reporters. Well, of course, as I was writing the book, more things were coming out, as you mentioned, day by day. So I tried to write in general terms. But, you know, we saw revelations that Fox reporters were spied on. We had, in the book I mentioned, how Hewlett-Packard actually hired private companies. And that's one of the themes of the book, is how we work so closely with the private sector to monitor our activities. But Hewlett-Packard engaged in what they really... It was called pretexting, and it was investigators pretending they were reporters to get information to find out the source of leaks that were happening at Hewlett-Packard. And a court found that, of course, unlawful, and they had Senate hearings about it. But I think that on all levels, we do see both conservatives, liberals, being monitored since it's so pervasive in everything we do.
Heidi Boghossian's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. We'll talk more with Heidi when we come back from this break and take your phone calls and emails as well. We'll also take your phone calls for Fall Fund Drive 2013 in its final hours right now. And we're at $136,574. Need to make $190,000 before the end of the day. $190,000. Please call now, 888-552-6191. On Thank You. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Heidi Boghossian. She is a lawyer and also the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild and the author of the book called Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. It's from City Lights Books. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 541-552-6782. That's the Rogue Valley number in use across the region, 541-552-6782. Add a 1 if you're not in the Rogue Valley. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. How did you end up putting this book to bed and finally getting a version that was going to arrive on the newsstands, Heidi, given the fact that it seems like the changes were coming pretty much daily about the time this book actually hit the newsstands?
Well, I actually finished it a little over a month before Edward Snowden came forth with his revelations. So in a way, I was fortunate that I had put it to bed. But it was difficult because every day I would read the business sections of the New York Times, and it just seemed that it never stopped. More and more, as technology, of course, gets more sophisticated, we're finding out both about abuses and about the many wonderful aspects of technology. And I think that's what makes this subject such an interesting one, is that as we've become reliant on personal devices to conduct so much of our lives, it's really changed the way our minds operate and how we think about information. And, of course, the convenience that those things bring. So, again, I tried to keep things in relatively general terms, and I divided the book into chapters that could sort of stand alone given the subject matter.
One of the concepts, then, that really needs to be brought forward is this phrase you term normalizing cultural obedience. Does this mean we accept less privacy and often willingly?
I think definitely as the Internet and computers, personal computers, have really crept into our lives over the last few decades, And his corporations play a much larger role in our daily lives. That is combined to really anesthetize us in a certain way about the limits on intrusion, so that we're accustomed to even, you know, when you go to a doctor's office. I was there the other week and they asked for my social security number. So many people just automatically write in that information. I don't know whether it's an authority thing, you feel like you have to, but I've stopped doing that. No one's ever questioned it. And I think when you go online and buy something, people are used to filling in personal information, or even when we fill out, say, product registration cards. It may ask, how many people are in your family? What's your income? None of that is needed to register the product, but it's used to go into vast data aggregators such as Axiom into their files, so they can really create profiles of how we are consumers. The problem is those profiles are then sold to third parties, even the government, and may be used for obviously other reasons, such as profiling us according to our political or ideological beliefs. And that's where it gets to the point of you have to ask yourself, how much do I want government and big business knowing about my life?
Let us take a call, which I believe is on that very subject. Mike in Eagle Point, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Heidi Bogosian, the author of Spying on Democracy.
Good morning. Yes, you've just begun to touch on a concern of mine, is that corporate entities collect an awful lot of information on us, and they're largely unaccountable and don't necessarily have our best interests at heart. Amazon.com knows what I read. Fred Meyers, which is a division of the Kroger department store chain, knows what I eat, what my personal hygiene products are, and what kind of pharmaceuticals I buy. And while I think it's well to be concerned about the information that government collects on us, I'm at least as wary of what big business has about us.
All right. Thanks for that, Mike. Appreciate it. Heidi, your thoughts?
Yes. And that's exactly why I think that we're entering a period, thanks to a lot of the revelations, where attention is being placed on the role that corporations play and their close partnership with the government. So we're having some reforms being introduced this week by Congress about surveillance. And I think that one of the tricky things is that because the government entities, such as the FBI and other surveillance groups, are restricted really by constitutional limits, the Fourth Amendment prohibition against unreasonable government searches and seizures, it seems that with a close relationship with business, that sort of having corporations serve as a long arm of the government and getting information that really government agencies cannot lawfully obtain. So what I think that people should be aware of is greater reforms in terms of how data is gathered, you know, giving notice, for example, online when children interact with, you know, Coca-Cola or McDonald's. And parents need to be aware that sometimes, you know, their child's information is being gathered. There are reforms underway now, thanks to the efforts of several grassroots groups. But I think there needs to be a larger awareness that these data aggregators, for example, really are going beyond what I think most Americans know. There were some great articles about Axiom. They're one of the largest, saying really that they probably know more about you than many of your friends do, because this information is gathered over time from various sources. And again, there's a high rate of inaccuracy, which is also a problem, because you have no way of knowing what information is being stored for years at a time on you, and you have no way to correct it.
So Axiom is a private company?
Axiom is a private company, and what's very interesting is that I think right after all of the revelations about data aggregation and, you know, government surveillance came out, Axiom introduced a little website called aboutthedata.com. And what they're saying is that they're going to be more transparent, and people can go to that, put their name in, and find out what information they have about you. Now, I did it, and they didn't have that much about me. But what they're offering is that if you find something incorrect, you can let them know, which people should be aware is yet another way, I think very cleverly, for them to tout transparency but actually get more accurate.
Oh, so see, so we got this wrong about you. Can you correct us on this? Oh, sure.
Exactly.
Then, yeah, correct the information. Now they
right.
have it. Axiom, A-C-X-I-O-M?
A-C-X, yes, I-O-M.
Okay, interesting. Let's take another call from Tawasi in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with the author of Spying on Democracy, Heidi Boghossian.
Thanks. Thanks for addressing this topic. I was hoping, Heidi, that you could speak to the issue of political prisoners. I know in the time right before the NATO protest in Chicago, there were early morning raids where people were preemptively arrested that were supposedly going to protest, but then accused with this whole laundry list of things just to get them to try and plea bargain. So there's all these grand jury resistors and other political prisoners. I was hoping I could get you to speak to that issue.
All right. Thanks for that, Tawasi.
In fact, that's probably the initial reason that I started to write this book, because through my work at the National Lawyers Guild, we do a lot of defense of individuals who have been, as you mentioned, the subject of raids, really of being labeled, especially environmental animal rights activists as well as anti-war protesters. So I started out wanting to talk about how those groups are really subject to very traditional FBI methods, as it were, that we saw during COINTELPRO, of being vilified in the media, being, you know, in the case of animal rights and environmental activists, the government worked closely a couple of decades ago with a Washington public relations firm to come up with the term eco-terrorism. And then we have the group ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange group that works to come up with model legislation, and they work with government entities and members of Congress. They passed the Stand Your Ground law, but they also did the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which they'd been trying to pass for several years, but a few years after 9/11 it went through with little public notice, basically in many ways criminalizing legitimate acts of protest that have as a result loss of profit on the behalf of animal enterprise, you know, a puppy mill or even a grocery market, for example. If protesters go outside and it causes a loss of profit, there could be a lawsuit. And I think we've seen very much, and often it comes out by accident, the use of infiltrators and agents provocateurs. We definitely see those before national special security events like the NATO summit that you mentioned, and the RNC and DNC. We see a lot of FBI activity going around the country, visiting with activists and their family members who ask questions about whether they plan to attend an event. And then we see, it happened in Texas as well as Chicago and Cleveland, that in fact members of law enforcement, either from local fusion centers or joint terrorism task forces, were undercover, acting as though they were, you know, activists, but often really putting forth ideas of engaging in violent activities that many individuals never would have wanted to or thought of. So we see what we call entrapment in many cases, and a trend really to criminalize domestic activism. And I think it's because it's an easy case for them to make to show that they're doing something on the so-called war on terror. So domestic dissenters become really the front line for a lot of these activities that we think could be better used looking after credible threat assessments.
Heidi Boghossian is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild and the author of the book Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. You can join us on the exchange. One phone number and line available today, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. But based on what you just said, Heidi, I mean, the response we often hear from law enforcement agencies is this is how we find the people. We go out and do these things that look like entrapment to some people.
Well, You know, I'd like to see more evidence that that's how they find people. In so many of the cases where agents were, you know, engaging in activities that we think were coercive or entrapment, you find out months or even years later that there were problems in those cases. What happens, though, is, and I've noticed there seems to be a trend around holidays like the 4th of July or Thanksgiving, you'll hear about a big break in the case thanks to infiltrators. But very often they fall through. Very often we, you know, I think they're brought to send a message, especially in the case of activists, and the message that if you engage in dissent, you run the risk of being labeled a terrorist or having what we call a terrorism enhancement applied if they're given prison time that would make them serve more times. And I think it's a stigmatizing tactic. And in fact, there is no, you know, evidence. A lot of law enforcement agents have actually written in reports that they know, for example, that animal rights or environmental activists aren't a real threat, that they haven't engaged in violence. Yet what they say is there's a potential they may in the future, which fits into the paradigm of preemptive policing that we've seen since the events of 9/11, where there's almost really a large effort to predict what might happen and then to prevent that at the expense of First Amendment activity. So you see protesters penned in to a small free speech zone and really corralled between, you know, metal barricades. No longer can they go out and take to the streets or the parks as we used to be able to do and as we have a right to do.
Let us take another call. We have Mark and Arcata on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Heidi Boghossian, the author of Spying on Democracy.
Yes, I guess I'd like to frame this ongoing attack on our amendments. For example, like you mentioned, the right to privacy and illegal search and seizures, the Fourth Amendment. I think the attack needs to be framed in the context of the war on terror, as you were saying. Meaning, I think it's a pretext, really, to create a police state. Because if you look at 9/11, of course, it was all 15 of them were Saudi subjects, all 19 were Wahhabis. That is the official sect, extremist violent sect of the Saudi royal family. And the official number that's attached to the Saudis' financing of extremism abroad is $87 billion in the last two decades. But yet the government does nothing to stem the Saudi state's financing of these extremist madrasas all around the world. So I just think they work together, really, to create a pretext for a global police state. Let's just bring it down to a factual level here. Of course, in 2008, both houses of Congress passed legislation which gave the five largest telecoms in America retroactive immunity from criminal prosecution because they had participated in the NSA's illegal wiretapping program. And so when you talk about reforms that might come from the spying on Angela Merkel, et cetera, foreign leaders, what they mean by reform is that they make what was once an illegal activity, meaning warrantless wiretapping, then they make that legal. That's what our government is doing in partnership with big business. It's fascism, straight up.
All right, let's get a response. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate that.
So well said. And one of the points, well, two actually that I'd like to elaborate on, you mentioned the perpetual war on terror, and I think that's exactly right. You know, after the Cold War, we saw a steady decrease in spending for the military establishment. And what happened was electronics companies, computer companies expanded into new markets with equipment that was originally developed for military use, repurposing it really, companies such as Texas Instruments,
yeah, that really jumped out at me in the book.
Yeah, so they began selling computer and surveillance systems to the government. Now, obviously, the more we tout a, really, as you said, manufactured war on terror, the more it sustains those businesses and, you know, 70% of our U.S. intelligence, government intelligence, is performed through private sector contracts. There's also a revolving door between, for example, 3- and 4-star retired generals and admirals who retired between 2004 and 2008, took jobs with defense contractors or as consultants, and then they continue to advise the Department of Defense, which raises questions, obviously, of bias and conflict of interest. But we're definitely catering to Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, and it's something that, as long as we have this unidentified, vague, perpetual war on terror, I think these problems are going to continue.
Well, let's think about this in terms of the military-industrial complex more generally then. I mean, the fact is when there is a foreign enemy that we're in a buildup against, we need missile guidance systems and submarines and planes and tanks and all that stuff. But this is not a target quite like that we're talking about with the war on terror.
Do you need all of those against your own population? I don't think so. I don't really see the need to have a legitimate need to have the drones that are going to soon be flying over domestic airspace. Again, that was pushed through by wealthy lobbyists, the drone lobbyist, and stated that, in fact, a large number of those drones will be used for law enforcement purposes. Now, no one can argue that drones aren't useful in some situations, say a flood or a forest fire, you know, when the pilot's safety is at issue. But without guidelines about privacy, it's dangerous to fill our skies with them.
Much more to talk about. The book is Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. Heidi Boghossian, its author and our guest. It is also the final day of Fall Fund Drive here on Jefferson Public Radio. All the services shooting for $190,000. We're just shy of $139,000, so quite a bit of ground still left to cover here on Jefferson Public Radio. Please make that call of support as soon as you can, 888-552-6191, or online at ijpr.org. Thanks. It's the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Heidi Boghossian. She is from New York. She's the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild and the author of the book Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. You can join us on the exchange. One phone number today, 541-552-6782. Or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Heidi, I want to come back to a point made by Mark, our previous caller. A police state, do you really think that's where we're heading if this is all left unchecked?
Well, I hate to engage really in hyperbole, but I do think it does seem that we're heading that way. I mean, we see it on the ground at protests. We see with corporate sort of really intimately partnering with the government on so many different levels, what I think creating a pervasive state of surveillance where it has the conscious or not effect of making people aware of how they communicate, what they say. You tend to have people conforming more to the large corporate state. Especially when it's so difficult to separate the corporate from the government. And we see that in policing so often. I was in a Barnes & Noble in New York, and there was a New York City police officer with his weapon, his gun, monitoring the store. And I said, is this officer on private detail? And they said, yes, we find that it, you know, it has a good effect on keeping people sort of feeling safer. And I think that we've seen the excuse, and the last caller mentioned that, you know, this is all in the guise of keeping us safer. And yet, there are some studies out there saying that surveillance cameras on every corner don't, in fact, have a deterrent effect on crime. But we've become so conditioned that I think things we would have been utterly shocked at 20 or 30 years ago are now becoming, as you said, we're becoming desensitized to them, so that we're not surprised to see police officers in stores standing guard, and we willingly hand over information that I think we should really think twice about doing.
You get into a good history lesson in the book, though, in Spying on Democracy. I mean, we certainly get to the Hoover period on the FBI. We did talk about COINTELPRO earlier. But you go all the way back to the Alien and Sedition Acts, which leads to the question, have the periods when we have not been engaging in some kind of surveillance on citizens been the exception rather than the rule?
Well, it certainly seems, again, with the most recent presidential administrations, and I think it really harkens back to the so-called war on drugs, which I believe started during the Nixon administration. When you create a fear, sort of a vague, amorphous fear of something, whether it be drugs and now terror. The problem being with the terror argument, we did have an attack on U.S. soil, and the terrorist threat is real, in part, I would say, because we've done so much to anger other nations, including the revelations of spying on our allies through their cell phones, it's easy to sort of keep, to sustain this fear, the public fear, to take advantage of it and to say all of this is needed to make us safer, when in fact there is no indication that we've really made us any safer. And I do think that in some ways we've become more vulnerable as the American public stops trusting us, as our allied nations get suspicious, and as we see more and more money thrown into, for example, local law enforcement departments that have to justify getting funding from, like, the Department of Homeland Security by coming up with threat assessments. And that's where the activists often come in, because a rural jurisdiction might not have a credible terrorist threat, but they want to get some government money. And so they, you know, really exaggerate certain threat assessments at the peril of free speech.
I was reading about that part, the Urban Area Security Initiative, and grants to local agencies that, yeah, okay, there might be a problem with the people who run this farm stand, so we need a tank for it, which you know, you can giggle about, but the fact is it does net hardware for the local agencies.
Exactly.
Let us take a call. Here's Grumpy John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Heidi Boghossian, the author of Spying on Democracy.
Thank you so much, Heidi. I have three things to say. A free speech zone anywhere designates the rest of the country as a non-free speech zone. Number two, the no-fly list is an instrument of terror our government uses on us. And for those of you who do not believe that our government is preparing to a police state for us, justify the acquisition of over a billion rounds of ammunition by Homeland Security. These rounds are illegal in war, and yet they are bought by our government to put us down. This is a fact, folks. Wake up. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Grumpy John. Appreciate that. Heidi, thoughts?
An excellent point that I'd like to mention. Right after the Boston Marathon bombing, we had politicians calling for more cameras. Everyone was praising the kind of surveillance. But what I think was the most horrifying thing about that was that they basically locked down Boston. It was a police state. In an effort to catch the two young men they were, you know, tracking, they imposed martial law. And there was very little really cries for how wrong that was and how that was a police state. And I think that's an indication of how the government will seize on any excuse. Again, public fears, and then, you know, using the Miranda exception so that you don't have to read someone their rights when they're in custody. That happened there. And so we're seeing what we call the sort of terrorist exception to the Constitution, which doesn't exist, but you'll see our elected officials really playing into those fears and those unlawful activities on the part of government leaders, local and federal.
The billion rounds he talked about for Homeland Security, I'd heard the other version of that with the Social Security Administration buying some rounds. There was some credibility to that, but for reasons that they explained. But, I mean, had you heard about the billion rounds for Homeland Security?
Well, I'm going to look into that because I believe it. I'm not that familiar with it, but I can say that, as anyone who goes to a protest knows, we have so-called less lethal weapons being used against protesters, you know, rubber bullets, mm-hmm. concussion grenades. So we're seeing the instruments of war used increasingly against United States citizens. And this is a very frightening specter.
We have an email here from Drew, no town given. He says, any thoughts about local police in uniform identifying themselves as pizza delivery when knocking at the gate of a private property? Seems like we have lots of authorities, local police or NSA at all, taking liberties whenever they can get away with it.
Well, we do know that police, for example, in an interrogation setting are allowed to engage in deception. You know, they don't have to tell the truth, and unfortunately the limits to what they can say would be shocking to many, to really intimidate people to speak up when they're being interrogated. And I understand that there's a certain amount of deception that's allowed. I'm not that familiar with all the limits on this, but I think that some of these blurring of the lines we'll be seeing more and more. And again, it's something that I would urge people in your local communities to go to your city council or to go to the community. We have in New York community precinct council meetings of the police department. People need to speak up when this happens, because I think that there are certain expectations about, you know, what law enforcement can and cannot do. We need to be clear on that. And, you know, if you're in a store and you see a police officer with a gun, find out, are they, you know, being paid by their local police department, or are they being paid by the business? It's very confusing, and I think sometimes results in not only possible conflicts of interest, but safety issues. You know, if a guard is in a bookstore, a police officer is in a bookstore, someone's attacked right outside, does he or she go respond to that? They're just things that we should know. And the deception, I think also you can try to talk to the local police departments, find out, and say, we don't like this.
We have a final email here from Randy and Roosh. He says, privacy in the modern world is over. If you own a cell phone, use credit cards, buy online, your privacy is long gone. You think that's a fair statement?
Unfortunately, it is a fair statement. Do I think it's hopeless? No. I think we can try to reclaim some of that privacy, again, being aware of when you're willingly handing over information. And, of course, that's a lot of what we do during our transactions. But, you know, much as we rely on technology for everything that we do, I think, you know, it's okay to take a break once in a while, step back and say, you know, maybe I want to pay with cash. Don't sign up for a loyalty card. Find out what the limits are in your life of how much you want to make available to retailers and the government. And I still know a couple of people without cell phones. It's very rare. But you can find a plan maybe that hopefully corporations will be addressing some of these issues as the public does speak out more about them. But I think we can make certain choices about what providers we use, look into getting things like Tor encryption on your computer. Obviously, none of it is perfect, but I think there are measures we can take to dial back a little bit in the extent to which we're complicit in the sharing of data.
All right. I did check at the aboutthedata.com site when they started asking for the last four digits of my Social Security number and my email address as required fields. I said, no, I'm done with this. So thanks so much for joining us today, Heidi Boghossian. The book is Spying on Democracy. Good to have you here on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much.
You bet.